Yeah, normally I do stand when I speak, but we'll get to that. And it's been quite an adventure. My name is Jim, and I am an alcoholic.
Yes, sir.
My sobriety date is August 10th, 2004. I do have a home group. It's Old Town Speakers, I was going to say. And that would have made Doug very happy. It's Hope is Here. Tuesday nights at 8:30, it's a closed speaker meeting. It's a hybrid meeting. Then we let people share afterwards. If you're up in Old Town, come up and see us. It's a great meeting. I want to thank Dave and Doug for our spiritual trip down here. That's just the way it is, you know. This used to be my favorite weekend of the year when I was drinking because the ACC tournament was going on. I would take off Thursday and Friday. I couldn't tell you score, but I did take those days off. And it's Selection Sunday. And then we have Wednesday, which is amateur night. And that's St. Patrick's Day. And and after a while, you start, for me at least, it doesn't really matter. Every night St. Patrick's Day. So it just doesn't matter. I'm a spoiled, rotten little kid. That's what I was. Just to get all the little things out of the way, I'm 48. I'll be 49 this year. So that means I didn't get sober until I was like 43 years old. So I waited a long time for things to get bad enough, or I thought they were bad enough, by the way, because everyone else thought they were bad a lot sooner than I did. But that didn't matter because it wasn't hurting me at all. And that's what it's all about. It's about me. I was born out in Southern California to two parents. I was the firstborn, and they just thought I was the bee's knees. They thought I was absolutely wonderful. They thought I was the second coming, and that's just the way it was. My father and mother dated only each other all the way through from the time you start dating until they were married until my father's death. There wasn't a lot of in between, and it was made very clear that mom and dad came first, and that was fine, and they loved the kids very much. And my parents made a second mistake. They had my sister. They didn't check with me at all, and I thought that was very rude of them. And then they decided to move out from California out here to Virginia. And they didn't ask me what I thought, so I decided to tell them. And as we were loading up the car, I stood on the curb and said, "I'm not going." Now, if you were born in the 70s or 80s, you know, you can't do this anymore, but my father said, "That'll be fine." And he got in the car and drove off. And now, you know, for a little kid like I was at the time, you know, it was like, this is not good. I mean, I didn't know anybody who was hiring little kids at the time. And, you know, I knew the neighbors were around. They'd probably take care of me for a couple of days. And Dad pulled back up again and said, "You want to go to Virginia?" And I said, "Very much so." And I got in the car, and that's the way it was, you know. And we moved out here to Virginia, and the first thing I noticed is there was no beach in Falls Church, Virginia. Because when we were in California, you walk out and saw that beach. But, you know, this is when I started to, you know, having been brought up as the only child for a long time and having thoughts of how Jim's world should go, everything had to come my way. And then eventually I started becoming aware of how we were being raised from a religious point of view. And I'm Catholic by education, Catholic by faith, and my parents. But the funny thing was, when I sat in church, everyone in that church in my family, well, the family when we were sitting in church, they heard one thing, which was there's this loving God and that they would be taken care of. And that's not what I heard. I heard about this hateful, spiteful God, and the best I could do was purgatory. And I'd be left there for a long time. I just knew it because I was thinking things back then that weren't right. And there was that priest, and you look up and you see that cross up there, and you go, "Who's that?" And he goes, "That's God, and that's His only Son." And I said, "That's His only Son, and that's what He does to him?" And I said to myself, "Oh my goodness, I'm in big trouble." And that's the way I started dealing with these things. Is to say, okay. So I had really questions about it. I had a lot of fear about that part of life. I said, you know what? I'm young. God and I can just stay on the opposite side of the street. We'll be fine. And I was raised with a good father and a good mother. They taught me the most important lesson I learned was to work hard and you can have anything you want. And that was very important later in life because when I wanted to drink, I had to buy it. And that was one thing I knew was important, is that you can't buy things if you don't have a job or not going to steal it. I can steal later, but you know, the reality of it was, is they set that as an early tone and said, you have to work for the things that you want. And I thank God for that, because when I was drinking, that was the only thing that made work tolerable to go to, was I knew that I would get the alcohol that I eventually needed. As going through life, I just thought bad things shouldn't happen to us. And in general, you know, very simple. We were raised on CBS television, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, Carol Burnett. My father's big night out was, or for Sunday, was getting to church in time, 10:30 mass, getting in home and watch the Redskins and having a bologna sandwich. That was his big thing. He had the very first remote control in the neighborhood. His name was Jim. He taught me how to fix the antennas. We only had four stations. We had CBS, ABC, some generic, and NBC. And that's what we would watch. And that was all there was. And he'd say, get up, turn the channel. Get up, turn the channel. That's all he did. And I'm like, Merck, get up and turn the channel. It went downhill, by the way, because it went to my little sister and eventually to my little brother that came along also, again, without my approval. We had another third little person join us. As I got into school, I was again Catholic educated, and most of the teachers were nuns, and they didn't tolerate a whole lot. And it was St. James Elementary still sits up there in Falls Church, and I think they air conditioned it finally now. But one of the nuns, what they used to do for disciplinary things in the summer was close all the windows and just make it nice and warm. Now they're wearing like wool outfits, and I'm like, you got to be nuts! And they're just sitting up there going, oh, that's no problem for us, and we're melting in the seats. And there was one point in that I learned later on how much my father loved me. And it was right before my birthday, and I was acting up. I know Doug and Dave would never believe I'd be acting up in public, but I was acting up, and the sister literally cracked me across my knuckles with a ruler. And I came home, and I was crying like a dog, a big dog. And my mother said, wait till your father gets home. And I went, oh, this is... And it's not, when wake your father is talking about, nothing is going to go right. And that's just the way it was. So my father came home. He heard the story. And on that Monday morning, he said, I'm taking you to school. And I went, oh, no. So we rolled into school. And I didn't go to my class. He took me down to the principal's office. He said, I'm going to go in and talk to the teachers. Talk to the principal. And he went in. And... he went in and he was in there for about 10 minutes, and I'm like, oh, this is not going to go good. And he called me in and he said, Jim, apologize to the teachers and tell them there will not be any more trouble. And I said, I'm sorry, there will not be any more trouble. And I hated my father right then and there. I said, how can you make them apologize? How can you do that to me? Well, I have to tell you, about a year ago, maybe less than that, maybe 6 months ago, I found out what happened was my father actually went in and told the nuns, you'll never hit my child again. And if you can't agree to that, I'll take him out of school right now. But he wanted to make sure that I understood that I didn't have no right to act up. So I'm getting good information from the very get-go, but I'm not going to apply it. My very right after that, eighth grade, had my very first experience with alcohol, and it was magical. Two of my friends stole a bottle of Old Granddad. And, oh my God. In eighth grade, it didn't matter. That stuff was sweet. And, you know, I'm old enough to know that 66 inside the Beltway did not exist. I mean, it was right between me and where we played school, up at O'Connell High School. So we would go down the bike trail and then have to cut over. And I had pitched the night before, so I wasn't supposed to play the rest of the week. We were supposed to end at Sunday. So it was a perfect day to drink. I wasn't supposed to play. And so I said, great, so we can, you know. And all of a sudden, we get up to that Little League field, and... you know, life just went away for some reason. I don't know what happened. It was just like, I just started running, you know, it's like, uh-oh. I thought I was running in circles, but I was really standing still, you know, with the buzz hit and everything. And we didn't have a lot of kids back then in our elementary school, and our right fielder didn't show up. So they said, Jim, can you play right field? And I went, oh, this isn't going to end good. So I went out there to right field, and all of a sudden, everything is being hit out to right field. I'm like, oh, this, okay, God, I get it. You know, I'm like, you son of a... And it's just God doing it to me again. I mean, I'm out there, I mean, you know, kids in eighth grade never sweat. And I'm out there sweating bullets, and they're wondering why, you know. And it's like, why does he smell like cough syrup? you know, and that was my first experience with it. It was terrible. I came off the field, and later that night I threw up, and I said, let's do that again. And there, you know, for my father, you know, one of the things that, you know, one of the things he liked was Miller Genuine Draft and those little pony bottles. Oh, he loved those. I mean, they're like gone in a sip. And if you let your son get to it first, they were gone in less than a sip. Because I would take a little blast, and that's where my love of beer came along. About my sophomore year, in, my freshman year in high school, my uncle passed away, who I did not know. And my parents thought it was a good idea that they go to my father's brother's funeral. And off they went with my little brother and my mother, and they went off to Connecticut while we stayed here to stay in school and keep the education going. On the way back on a Friday afternoon, coming back from Connecticut, my little brother was killed in a car accident, one car accident. He was literally sucked out of the back of another Pinto station wagon and was killed up and on the New York highways. And why that's important was it did two things to me personally. One, it said, there is no God again. Why are you taking a little kid like that? Because this is a smart little kid. I mean, he was just a great little kid. But on top of that, the man that was teaching me how to be a man, that was doing everything a parent could, you know, he was my little league coach, my football coach. And you know, when you're a little kid, you don't understand the sacrifices parents make when they take on these commitments, when they have to leave work early, and they have to do those things to be available to you, and the practices and everything else that go to them. That, you know, but here he was when he got home, sitting on the couch, just crying his eyes out. And I'm like, you son of a bitch. And that's how God was for me. How can you hurt this man that is as passionate about you as anything else, and he is just absolutely here, devastated. Why would you? And then, of course, my mother is just absolutely losing it. Within 2 years, my father developed cancer, and by my senior year, he passed away also. And there was left with my mother, my sister, and myself. We were the only family members other than on my mother's side. And I'm like, I'm done. God, we're done. You know, purgatory, the hell with it. I'll just go straight to hell with it. I'm okay with that. I'm done with you. You just, tell you what, you don't throw too much at me, we'll be all right. Just don't. And from that point is, and the funny thing was, that just turned me off emotionally too. I was never going to invest in people again. Not for a long, long time. That doesn't mean I wouldn't take advantage of situations that looked like I was investing, but I truly wasn't going to. Talking to Dave about it, you know, and just getting back into it after a long period of time. But saying I love you just did not mean anything to me for a long period of my life. It was just something to say to get something else. And that didn't mean anything to me. I mean, it's just like saying, can I have a donut? I mean, it's just like, you know, it didn't mean anything. You see people, they say, I love you, and there's that commercial right now, the guy can't get I love you out. I have no trouble with it, because it doesn't mean anything to me. I don't understand what it meant. You say it all day long, I love you. Don't mean it. Good enough. And I started going down that path, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with my drunk log, because I think if you're here, you know about the drinking stuff. You basically have probably did it pretty well. You probably did it better than me. It's a funny thing, though. When I was like 19 years old, I had a real bad experience with rum. And I still would swear to God. I go, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to drink rum. I'm not going to become an alcoholic either, so I'll just drink beer. And that's what I did. Now, I'll just tell you that from the time I was about 18, and that was the day I turned professional as a drinker, until the time I stopped, I was averaging about 16 beers a night. A little less in the beginning, a little more at the end. But if you averaged them all out, it was 16 beers every day. And I didn't stop for illnesses, work, anything else. It was just a straight-through blur. I do not know. If you put a gun to my head, I do not know when the fun stopped and the trouble started. I have no idea of when it could have been any day, but it wasn't. But I'll tell you one thing I do know. I started taking prisoners about the age of 20. And they were family members, they were friends, and I would use them because it was just what I did. I needed stuff. And I always thought stuff was the answer. And it's a funny thing. You know, when I was drinking, I had all the stuff that I wanted. None of it made me happy. but I'd always be new cars. You know, Dave talks about a lot, got to get that woman. Got the woman, got to get rid of that woman. You know, you go right down the list and you just got to get a new woman. You know, you just keep traveling through the path and you just start taking prisoners. You start trying to figure out how long is too long to stay at family events, if you went at all. I can't tell you how many times I would call up and 5 minutes before I'd be there going, I don't think I can make it. And it didn't mean a thing to me. It's just like, you know, and my sister would plead with me, Mom's just waiting for you downstairs. And so, tell her I ain't coming. Because I wouldn't call my mom. I'd call my sister to tell my mom. Because I'm a very brave person on top of all this. my first job, when I came out of school, I was looking for, you know, first of all, I didn't want to work, but it seemed like my father told me you had to because you needed money. And I equated everything, my bills, with drinking, which is cool. Like, the rent was a certain number of beers, so if you did not pay your rent, you had enough beer. If you didn't pay your car payment, and then you had enough beer. And then, you know, another bills would come up, and I would sit there, and this is when you could, like, write a check, and it wouldn't quite hit the right time, or you do the little things like not sign the check, or you send the gas bill to the electric company and the electric company to the rent people. How did that happen? They go, I don't know. It's the third time you've done it. Well, it's definitely not my fault if that's what you're implying. I'll get the money out of the mail to you today. You know, and it's kind of funny now the way I pay my bills now. I have a little system now. But anyways, you know, that's the way I was. I did that with friends. Yes, you know, I always thought, I always had the best of intentions when I borrowed money from you. Or stole it from you. I always took them as loans. You know, I had every intention of paying you back. It just was going to be on my timetable. And it wasn't going to be with interest. And I, you know, and that's what I did. I used people up. And then I noticed that people were getting married. Friends of mine were getting married. So what else do? You take another hostage, you get married. That's my job. And I had known this. I had known the girl since kindergarten, and she knew the way I was drinking. So you could see where it's her fault already. You know, she knew the way I drank. And so, you know, what could she expect from a drunk? I mean, that's the way it was. So if she was going to marry me and she didn't like it, that was her fault as far as I was concerned. And that's the way it was. I told you I went into the travel business, and I just, by the way, I should tell you that I use road signs. I'm saying I'm changing directions every once in a while because I do this with Dave all the time. If I change directions real quick, I'll try to help you let you know that I changed directions so you can stay with me here. But I'm changing directions to my career path. I went back to being a travel agent because I also found out that they traveled. And so I got to see places like New Orleans. And when you're an alcoholic, you know, and they call you up on a Friday afternoon and say, do you want to go to New Orleans? Yes, I do. And, you know, and you're supposed to be back on, like, Sunday afternoon. Well, I would always make it back by Wednesday-ish. You know, I got down there one weekend. We were in New Orleans, and I'm 23 years old, and Tulane is playing LSU in the Superdome. I'm going, co-eds, nice. And we're down there. We're in the French Quarter, and they let you drink alcohol in the streets. I'm like, this is great. I can drink and fall asleep at the same time. I can just lay down. Why would you do that? I was just laid right down. Here I am. Gutter, middle of the street. It didn't matter. Just take a little nap. Just roll me over. I'll be fine. And it really was. I was supposed to make a flight out Sunday night, and I missed that. So I said, oh, might as well take Monday and Tuesday off. And I missed them. We're staying in a real nice hotel. And one of the things that happened to me down when I was in New Orleans is we were staying on the Hilton, I think it was. And I came out of a blackout in a glass elevator that faced the Mississippi River. And I looked up and I went, oh, shit. And we were going up. But we were going up. And I thought, oh, this is good. I'm not going to hell. But I just figured, this is it. I'm going to be saved. I said, oh, well, look at that. I made purgatory. And then I'm a certain I was going to hell. But I'm like, oh, good. And then ding, my four. Thank you. Got the key. And that's the way that was. Now I'm changing courses again and deciding that my friends are getting married. That's what adults do. So I got married. I got tired of the travel business and decided that it was a good time to make another career move. So I went into the... where did I go next? Anyways, I actually would say I'd stay a travel agent while I was married. excuse me, before I make that career move. And my wife just started on me about my drinking. And she had an ultimatum. I don't know how it went, because all I heard was it's either the drinking or. But I didn't hear anything else she said after that. See, I don't know what she said. She could have said it could be jackpot or it could be anything else, but if she was making me make a choice between drinking and anything else, I'm going with drinking. And I told her that. I said, I'm drinking. I'm done. You know, if you're going to put that kind of choice in, that's fine. I'm leaving. And I did what any good alcoholic does. I went in and I got my custom luggage, which was Glad bags. I put all my stuff in two green bags, and got out of the house. They're yelling and screaming, my dog yipping at me. My dog, by the way. I'm leaving my dog behind. I mean, Nelson's coming with me. I got down to my car. I threw it all in the back. And I had a really, really good idea. So I called my boss as I just left my house and my marriage at that point and said I quit. So I thought, you know, might as well. If we're going to do it right, let's do it all the way right. I'm tired. I quit. And I just went, we're done. And now I don't have a job. I don't have a house. So I did the next right thing, which was to head to the Outer Banks in North Carolina. I had a friend down there building a house, for a vacation house for him, and thinking that was going to be the right thing, I asked if he needed any help, and he said yes. I said, okay, I'll be right there. And he paid me for a room and board, and he gave me a little bit of money so that I continued to drink. Now, he didn't drink the way I drank, but at least he drank, and that was really good. It's funny though, today, even today, I watched the Weather Channel because I swear to God we built a load-bearing beam out of duct tape. I'm just absolutely certain. When we see a storm go through the Outer Banks, I'm like, oh shit, please stay up. And it's been over 20 years, so we think, okay, it's pretty cool, it should be okay now. But, you know, building and drinking is just like two things that shouldn't go together. And when I got done with that, and I was really pissed off when I was done, it's like, well, what other house are we going to build next? And he's like, that's it, we're done. The house is done. I'm like, well, what am I going to do? He goes, we ain't living here. He had enough of my act, and I did what every strong male does when he's faced with problems and doesn't know what to do. He drove back home to Mommy's house. And that's exactly what I did. I drove back to Mommy and said, Mommy, I don't know if I can live no more. And she said, okay, come in, you can live with me. Just like moms do. And how my mom has always been. She's always been sticking by my side. You know, she's always been there through all the crap that I put her through. And she believed every story. I don't know if she believed them, but she certainly just said, you know what, I'll tolerate that. I'll just do that. So I moved in there. And then I found a firm that was hiring anybody. I mean, if you breathed, that was the application. If you had a breath in you, you got hired. And I barely passed. And I went in there, and they said, we're going to drug test. I said, give me 2 days, we'll be okay. There was some stuff I was worried about. But I went in there, and I got hired. And we started building the first of the buildings in the area for this company that is now relatively large. And I was in paradise. So after the building was done, we had to set, there's a big box company that uses a lot of orange in it. I'll just say that, and you can all figure it out from there. And we have to set our own steel in these 130,000 square foot facilities, and we have to do our own racking. But at the end of the day, they would bring in a keg of beer on a pallet, and we would just sit there and drink until the reasonable hour, getting paid for it. And then, you know, we go on with the next day. But at the end, just a nice drinking outfit all of a sudden. And again, like I said, they'd hire anybody, and I was anybody. So they just kept promoting me. And as we're going through, I'm making more and more money. I'm drinking more and more at night because the responsibility is getting to me more and more. And I have a feeling right then it started to get to me because now I'm being asked to be a manager. And when we first opened up, we only had 3 stores in Northern Virginia. And now you can't swing a cat without hitting these big orange boxes anymore. But they kept promoting me, and they promoted me over to management. And all I can remember was that's when I knew I was starting to feel the effects of alcohol. I was starting to really, really feel it. And so I ran away inside the company. They opened up a new branch of this big orange company that I said I'd join up with. And off to New Jersey, because people in New Jersey had not met me yet. I thought it was safe up there, and you didn't have to pump your own gas. They had people that would pump it for you. I was all for that, and I lived in a hotel for New Jersey for 1 year. Well, because they said, you know what, we need to open up the Midwest market with this chain, and after that was done, I moved out to Chicago. And the only thing I remember about Chicago that was good was the stores were opened up for 23 hours a day in Chicago. They only closed for 1 hour between, I think it was like 4 and 5 in the morning. And that pissed me off because I didn't understand what they were doing for that 1 hour. It didn't look busy to me. I don't know why they couldn't sell me alcohol, make me wait in that parking lot for 59 extra minutes. Because I'd always go in right when they were closing. But, I mean, can you imagine that? I can't buy beer in time with this place that's open for 23 hours a day. I'm like, what is going on here? And the funny thing about Chicago was, now it's really starting to catch up to me. And 9/11 hit that day. And this is where I talk about not having any emotion in life. I didn't care. It was just another day on the calendar. All these people, we had people that are in the store that had relatives in New York, and I didn't care. And they're like, someone's got to talk to this staffing of 165 people. Everyone is devastated out there. And then they said, Jim, you talk to them. I said, sure, because I didn't care. I was sitting there just lying to them. I know you feel bad about today. We're going to be okay. You know, we've got all these great programs that will take care of you. Because I didn't care. I had a brother-in-law, and Doug's read the book, who is a firefighter. He was on the Pentagon. He was one of the first respondents on the Pentagon. And I didn't care. My sister's husband's the father of three of my nephews and nieces. They said, hey, Dennis is in the Pentagon. Okay, so? Your God will take care of him. Because mine's not going to. You pray to your God and see what happens. I didn't care. I didn't care what happened. I was more pissed off that they canceled football that weekend than I was about what happened. That's the depth of emotion that alcohol had taken me to at that point. I just didn't care. I had no feelings for it whatsoever. That's how, you know, mom's calling me up saying we can't get a hold of Dennis. We don't know. You know, cell phones weren't working. Nothing was working in the area. We don't know. You know, Dennis didn't come back for 2 days. He went in on a Tuesday morning. It was funny because he had went in and he was supposed to be off that morning, and he stayed because he had the opportunity to work some overtime. So he stayed with his unit. And Dennis is at the Pentagon. Big deal. Just another day. And I'm watching, and I'm sitting there pissed off because they also canceled all the television programs. We're watching the same thing over and over and over again. Don't care. Went in the next day and they gave me an award for being a good employee. Because I was the one that was stabilizing everyone else. Like, oh, yeah, this is great. I came back to this area after I really started. I had worn out my welcome, is what I really should say. I worn out my welcome in Chicago, and I came back and I worked in the same store that I originally opened. And they brought me there because I'm this person with a lot of bubbly energy. Because I could fool you all. I mean, I had a lot of people fooled. I had that smile, I had the energy, I was like, but at night I'd go home and drink myself till I was done. But I would come in, and I remember we were only two salaried managers in a store that should have had five. And the two of us decided that we would work every other day from open to close, just so that we can get through with it. And it was, so we were there at 6 in the morning, we left at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and we had the next day off, and then we'd do it again the next day. And if we had conference calls, we came back. We were working these incredible amount of hours, and they weren't staffing our store, and they finally sent another assistant in. And it was my first adventure with hospitals. And it was a Saturday afternoon, and the place was going crazy. I had drank an incredible amount of alcohol the night before, even for me. And I was just feeling nervous, and I felt my heart pounding. And I go, well, I know I'm having a heart attack. I'm dying right here and now. And I can't die here in the store. So I called the manager up. He was nice enough to come back in and off to Fairfax Hospital that we were in. And they kind of diagnosed me right away. They were looking at me going, when's the last time you ate? I said, I don't remember. I'm really anxious right now. I feel like my heart's pounding. They took my blood pressure and it was this outrageous number. And they said, well, just get you some food and settle you down. And that was not the last time I would be in Fairfax Hospital for it with a heart attack. It wasn't a heart attack. It was just the anxiety of alcohol. And it happened several more times. And then I can remember, at least in my mind, this is the way I remember. Remember, it's my story. But the last time that it happened, they didn't even stop the ambulance. They just idled out front. They said, come on, get in, strap yourself in. They took me to Fairfax Hospital. They gave me my IV. And I understood hospital etiquette at that time. When you're like a drunk and you're wasting doctor's time, you move from the little cubicle to the wall, and then from the wall to the lobby, and then eventually you're out on the bus stand with your IV. And you're going home. They're done with you. They don't have time for you. So I went to the general practitioner, my general doctor, who I never had before in my life, and I said, there's something wrong with me. She did every test there could possibly be. She sent me to a cardiologist and a psychologist. I had a cardiologist, a psychologist, and a general doctor all working on my case, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, and I wasn't going to tell them. I mean, that was the problem. Because I knew it wasn't the alcohol. And the reason I knew this is because it was the only thing that worked, even if it was for a shorter period of time. What used to work through the whole night, now was only working for an hour at a time. When you drank that much alcohol as I did, that's all I wanted was that little bit of time where it just seemed like everything would stop. And I actually went out of work, and I was on leave because of all these problems I was having, and it was coming time for me to go back to work, and I wasn't ready because I was still just a wreck. And it was football season too, so I said, this is the perfect time to see if maybe, possibly, it had something to do with drinking. Because the psychologist I was seeing at the time, I didn't know it when I first met him, but he was actually in head of the Air Force's drug addiction program and alcohol counseling program. And he hit me right on the head. He said, do you think you could like cut back on your drinking a little bit? Well, I told him I was self-medicating. I mean, I love that word, self-medicating. I was getting drunk every night, but self-medicating is a much nicer way to say it. There was no medicine involved. When your clerk's named Apu, you know, when your doctor's named Apu and he's filling that prescription for you, there is no medicine involved. You know, I'm segueing again. I'm going another direction. I had a little 7-Eleven like store that I would go to all the time. And I was such a good customer that he would take my Miller Genuine Draft because he knew I liked it cold, and he would put it in his ice cream case. And he wouldn't let nobody else touch it till I got there. About 2 years later, after I had been sober for 2 years, we just happened to be up by a meeting that was by his store, and we went in there to get some drink, and I went, I can't go in there. Because in my head, I have this vision of Miller Genuine Draft just still pouring out. I'm like, and he'd go, where you been? going back and finally saying, it's football season. You know, and the doctor said, maybe you can cut back on your drinking a little bit. I said, okay, I can do that. So I went from 16 beers a night to 8 glasses. I thought that was a reasonable thing. What I didn't tell him was I bought a 26-ounce tumbler. And I would put two in, and to me, that's one glass, you know. Let's not talk, I cut back, at least in my own mind. And eventually says, you're going to need more help than it can be given here. You're more than self-medicating. You need to do something else. And I said, okay. And so he told me what he thought would be right, and he thought some sort of in-treatment drug from alcohol treatment would help. And I immediately went to researching that. And I found out I had a Blue Cross Blue Shield card, so that meant it was being paid for. So I had to find something that was going to work for me. And that meant comfy. That meant that I had to get fed. It had to be close by in case it didn't work out, and there was a 7-Eleven around the corner. Fairfax Hospital was perfect because they had all of that. There was a cats unit there. They woke you up. They fed you. Now, it was a little disturbing when they woke you up at 3 in the morning to find out if you were sleeping, but that was okay. They were providing the drugs. They just give you some more drugs and off you went. Now, you had to go to these AA meetings, which I knew was going to happen, but I had to go to AA because I wanted to learn how to drink appropriately for an adult. I figured you guys would at least teach me how to do that. And I wanted to know how I could drink during risk and Sundays to make it look like they were playing well. And then I could still go to work on Monday without the effects of the alcohol. and I can get back to being a civilized human being, maybe gain some of the things I lost. Well, what I found out is you guys had another idea. And you said, we don't have to drink. And that just absolutely baffled me. And that was on August 10th. And I was fortunate that day because I met men that are still here today in this program. And I thought I needed them that day, but I need them more now than I did then, which is funny. Because it's always day to day with me. And there were people there then that aren't here now, but they were still here to help me. I mean, that's my first sponsor, I would say, is not as active in AA as he once was. But thank God he was there when I needed him. And not to say that this is all about Jim, but it is. I mean, frankly, it really comes down to, what do I want to do about my sobriety? It's not me. Well, else's. I've seen it where people get sober for wives and husbands and girlfriends and boyfriends and jobs and Jill and everything else. And it doesn't work until it's about you taking care of yourself. And I was being introduced to more people that were saying the same things and were living life and they were happy. They weren't laughing just to laugh. They were actually happy with the way their lives were going. Now, I would tell you that when I was drinking, I was trying to replace happiness with stuff, cars, computers, not even computers, anything, anything, vacations. None of those things worked to bring me happiness. And I always was employed, which was amazing. I don't know how, that had to be something. It wasn't me. Somehow I always, like I said, I would ask for God's help when it was convenient for me. But I always would figure it out before He helped me. That's at least the way I saw it. I'd say, please God help me. And then something good would happen. I'd go, never mind God, I got it. And that's the way I honestly thought. I thought I'm smart enough. I can get out of these messes. I got it. But when I came back here and I started reading your steps on the wall and I went, well, I'll take a 3. And I think I can do 8, and I certainly can do 12. Because you sick people need help. And I'm here to help you. So, and I really thought all the steps were a buffet menu. I was like, oh, we'll just order off the supersize. And supersize number 12 for me. Because I want to help a lot of people when I'm here. And so this is the attitude that I brought into AA. And that was kindly, lovingly beaten out of me by people that were willing to take the time to show me what this is all about. I learned very quickly that get in the car is, it was not a suggestion. It was, and we did. And we did not stay close to home. We live in Northern Virginia, and there must be at least, I would say, 15, 20 meetings tonight in the Northern Virginia area. And almost every night there's 15 or 20 minutes. But we couldn't find those meetings. We'd have to go to Richmond. We'd have to come down here. We'd have to go to Dover, Pennsylvania. We'd have to go to Baltimore. I mean, I'm pulling out my where and when. I'm going, what the hell is this book for? I don't understand what you're doing. And I got to my first meeting in Harbor City, and I don't know if you all have been up there yet or seen it, but it was just an old church. And the first time I went to Harbor City, I didn't think I'd fit in. I swear to God. I said, oh my God, I'm not. I'm like 2 days out of treatment. And I'm going, I can't fit in here. And it wasn't a fact that I didn't like anybody. It was just that they crowded the stairway so tight, I didn't physically think I'd get in the freaking door. And then they want to touch you. They're patting you on the head and shaking your hand. I'm like, don't touch me. You don't understand who I am. And tell that to some of the people that I knew up there. One of the first guys I met up there, and he's a very good friend now, I was Dave. Everything's Dave's fault, by the way. And if you don't like what I said today, talk to Dave after the meeting. I'm going to wait for him in the car. Just kidding. Anyways, Dave takes me, and he partners me up with another guy that he's sponsoring at the time. And he says, you're responsible for Jim. You make sure he gets inside. And the first guy that we run across is this gentleman that looks at the guy that's supposed to protect me and says, hey, your village called, they want their idiot back. And this is my introduction to AA outside of treatment. I'm going, oh, this is going well. And then they gave me some real good advice. They said, it's a little warm in there. It's August, it's Baltimore, it's unair conditioned. They said, get a seat in front of the fan. I looked inside and there was a fan there. It had two blades and they were side by side. And the thing would swing all the way up the top and just give up. What the hell are you talking about? You're killing me here. I'm like, oh my God. But that night was probably the most changed my life right there, because they had this woman from Richmond speaking. And she sat there and just and told her story. And I'm like, holy crap. And she told it without any of the flowery stuff also. She told about how her family still at that point had not been talking to her. She was 14, 15 years sober at the time. And she said, you know, it didn't all get better. And she talked about how she felt when she drank, and it was how I felt when I drank. I said, I know that. I know that. And so for the first time in a while, I was identifying in instead of identifying out. I said, I'm like that person. Like, oh my goodness gracious, this is it. And I started to understand that. And I wanted this that you all were doing. I said, I've got to get more of this. And that's what happened. We came back in. And if you've never had the pleasure of a road trip in AA, I suggest you do so. We had a meeting on the way down. We'll have a meeting on the way back. And that's how it was. We left Baltimore. I thought we were done with the meetings. No, it started right back up. It threw in a speaker CD. And we listened all the way back. Never was an opportunity not taken advantage of when we were in a car together that they weren't talking about getting not just sober, but getting well. Because now that I had the alcohol out of my system, I was stuck with the worst thing you could have, which was me untreated. And there is nothing worse with me with ideas untreated. And that's the way I felt. And after I went back in, and this has been the story of the way it's been going for some time now, is I lost my job with a big box orange company. Well, I didn't really lose it. I knew where the building was. They just didn't want me to show up anymore. You know? So I was fired, okay? I was fired out of there on a stupid thing. This is when I knew AA was working, because I wasn't upset. I rolled out of there and I had a different sponsor at the time, and I called him up and I said, I'm pissed off because I'm not pissed off. I don't understand why I have some calmness and serenity here. Why am I not more upset than I should be? Should be, he said. What are you talking about? That's great, dude. And I said, okay. I was about 6 months sober when it happened. I told a friend of mine, Andy M., who's now out in Michigan, and I said, Andy, I was fired out of my... And I was crying to him, and he just said, good. Now you can focus on your sobriety more. I went, oh. Well, that's not what I wanted to do, though. And so we started going on 12-step calls. And that took me a while to figure out why I was going on the 12-step calls, because they would push me in the room first. I swear to God they knew that some of these guys were not stable. We would walk into places, you know, one guy had, I mean, and he was there, he had 42 leather coats. He goes, I have receipts. I'm like, okay, fella. And, you know, we went on 12-step calls, and I remember going with Andy one day to a 12-step call, and this gentleman was crying because he had bought the brand new Madden game for that year, but he forgot he had pawned his PlayStation. And he was very, very, very upset with this. And then he threw us out of the house, and I said, well, that didn't go well, and Andy looked at me, and Andy was about 2'8", and I towered over Andy, going, what's wrong, Andy? And Andy looked up at me and he said, are you sober? I said, yeah. He says, I am too. He said, it worked perfectly. I said, oh, that's the way it goes. Okay. And from that, I was always told to be ready to have your hand out and ready to turn this back in. I remember in my first year, Dave was driving. I offered him $20 for gas. He would have thought I slapped him in the face. He said, don't worry, you'll pay that back. I have paid that back. I paid that back in stays. That's why I didn't drive today. And other reasons. But I do want to come to the point where I am now in life and why I'm sitting here. It's funny when you think you get to a certain point and you think that you have a handle on everything. And you think that you have your will. And you're not going to give your will up very much. Well, I guess I thought I had one of those self-healing bodies, you know. And I would say probably October, early November, I started not feeling well. And I just didn't want to do anything about it. I had a couple jobs before then. I'm unemployed now. You know, these things that are not supposed to happen when you get sober. You know, life goes on. Things are happening to me. You know, I still feel like I'm in the center of the hurricane because I have this program. And I have people that will invest time with me now because what I've given has been given back to me now. And the best way I can explain it is that I went up from where I was weight-wise to up close to 400 pounds in a very short period of time. And I basically was drowning from the inside out. When I put my feet on the ground, I would have liquid literally coming out of the bottom of my feet. I thought that was a bad sign, but not too bad. I thought it'd be all right. You know, but I had swollen up so bad one night that I called my brother-in-law, who was an EMT and retired out of the fire department, and said, "Do you think I should go to the hospital?" And he's like, "Yeah, I think you should." And he called his ambulance company, and they came over. And in the middle of early December, they put me in the hospital. And my treatment up to the hospital was I always get out the next day because that's what drunks do. So I thought, okay, this is going to be exactly like this. I'm just going to be here for a day, but give me something and I'll be fine. My second day of consciousness, and this is going to come as a shock to them, I've kind of hinted at it, but I'm just going to get it out in the open because I did it last night also. Just leading a meeting, and I just had to come out because it's just nothing that was really all that big of a deal to me now. But I woke up out of consciousness and I found a priest giving me basically a blessing for the sick and dying. Or last rites. I was that sick. And they had me in a bed that weighed me. I was sweating through so many of those little bed sheets. You know, you can imagine. You know, not a good thing to have me in those little wraparound things because they're just doing a lot for me. I'm not a lot of coverage anyway, so they just said, lay there naked. And we'll just come in. And I was being given drugs 3 hours at a time, a lot of them intravenously, just to reduce the water weight. And the funny thing is, to take the pills, I needed water, but I could not take any more water in. They're like, you can't do that. I mean, they were like, this is ridiculous. Can't give you water, you can't take water, but you have to take pills. And I sat there, and you know, when you're naked in a hospital, and that's not going to leave you a lot of time. And for the first time in a long time, there was fear. And I hadn't felt fear in a long, long time. And here it was. It was just sitting there. Just true fear. What is it going to do? And my thought of a greater power, and I just call him God because it's easy to spell, and I know what it is. And it's dog backwards. And I just said, you got to help me. Or whatever you do next, just, you know, let's get on with it. And, you know, progressively, things started to change a little bit. Not overnight, not a miracle, not a burning bush. Just like recovery, a little bit at a time. And that's why I sit here tonight in the clothes I'm wearing tonight and the things I have, because I'm not fully there. I'm not out. I'm hoping I'm out of the woods, but I'm here tonight. And that's just grace. Because there was a time when someone else thought I wasn't going to be. And they go, And all these things, these ideas that there was a higher power, and no matter what would happen, you know, Dave would joke with me, well, someday or another it's going to end, either good or bad. And that was true. I mean, you know, that really brought it in. But the times I was in the hospital, to have the people who would come to my hospital room, the AA people, that would come in and spend time with me. At the right time, it just seemed like when I was despairing the most, I'd get that visit. Or when I got out of the hospital and was home, they would bring a meeting to my house. You know, for a guy like me, that didn't happen a whole lot. And, you know, I have gotten those gifts back. I have gotten my family back in my life. You know, I've gotten that honesty back. I'm not working. But you know, it doesn't matter. I look at my the things that make me mad, or the things I think I don't have, like a job, or a girlfriend right now, or a wife, or whatever. And then right now, I had to just say, those are minor inconveniences compared to everything else. When I go home tonight, I'm sleeping indoors. I have a roof over my head. I have food. I have friends. I have a way to get to meetings. And I don't have a car anymore because I turned it in because I couldn't afford it any longer. But I have made it around. I've asked. And that was hard for me, to ask for help. And I've asked for help. And you know, it was just that surrender all over again. And having to do that surrender, just like I had to do back on August 10th, is just surrender everything I had over and start again. And it's just absolutely amazing that if you do that surrender, and I'm not going to say there aren't big things to worry about, but you know what? There are a lot, most of the things that I worry about are little things that will go away in time. And I just keep the things that are going to be long term. Hopefully my sobriety, my family, my friends. I mean, those are the things that are important. My relationship with a higher power. You know, when I was drinking, I would drink to the point where I could just get some relief. And now, when I go home tonight, and every night it's been, I sit there and I do that 10th and 11th step. And you know, God knows what I did all day long. I mean, there's no doubt. He brings them back up again for me, and I have to remember that. And if I haven't had that, you know, if it's been just a normal day, it doesn't take long to talk to God. But when I know that I have to make that phone call to someone that I wasn't really charitable to, because I'm still capable of that. I wasn't struck anything close to perfect. I still enjoy torturing people sometimes, just for the fun of it. It's like a hobby. But I do know that I have to do something differently. I came across a lot of other, you know, other little adventures that were brought up was, you know, making up gratitude lists. It's kind of my little pet peeve. I make them up. But what do? You call the people that are on them and tell them thank you, or you just put them on a piece of paper and shuffle them away. That's not what it's about. You got to tell the people that helped you. You know, not just letting them, you know, let God do it for me. That's the way it is for me nowadays. And then all these things, it comes right back to that he did not have a shot at this until I was able to turn my life over to a higher power. And I'm going to close with something, because sponsors are really a pain in the butt. And I had this one sponsor for a period of time, and, you know, he had the best explanation of sponsorship. He told the story of a troubled young man that went into the Marine Corps. And his parents didn't really approve him going into the Marine Corps, didn't think it was the right thing to do. But they said, go ahead and do it. He needs some discipline in his life. And when it came time to graduate, they went into their son's barracks, and they looked at the condition that their son was living in. And his bed was perfect. His kit box was perfectly organized. His dress uniform, he wore it like it was like it was armor. He was yes sir, no sir man. He was doing all those things that his parents could not get them to do for the longest period of time in his life. So the mama went up to the drill sergeant and looked at him and said, "Drill sergeant, I've been trying to get my son to act this way his entire life. How the heck did you do it over 6 weeks?" And the drill sergeant looked down at her and said, "Ma'am, you love your son, and I do not." And I'm not saying that the sponsor doesn't have some feelings for you, but he's certainly more likely to tell you the truth because he doesn't want to be dancing. He doesn't want to be standing on your grave wondering what happened. He's going to tell you what's going to keep you safe. And I got into one of my modes where people weren't doing what they were supposed to do, and either were places and things. And I called my sponsor up and I told him, I said, people, if they would just listen to me and the things that they would just do what they're supposed to do and the places that, if they would just be where they're supposed to be. And he said, really? He said, you got a big book around? I said, yes, I do. And he has a third edition, so I had to translate for him. And he gave me the page number, and I had to find it in my book because I have a fourth edition. And this is what it said on that page. And it says, "And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it's because I find person, place, or thing, or situation, some fact in my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, or thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at that moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I accept my alcoholism, I cannot stay sober unless I accept life completely on life's terms. I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes." It's not in the first 164 pages, it's in the stories. And that has made all the difference. And he hung up real quick. I understood exactly what he meant. I have no power. And he even says so in How It Works. God has all power. May you find him now. He didn't even leave me a little power. He didn't say, "You have, I'm going to leave you a little bit." No, he said, "I have all the power." And so why would you not want to work with the one that has all the power? You know, it becomes very simple to say, let go of today and not worry about tomorrow. I'm not confused. I know God's not going to pay my bills and he's not going to wash my windows or cut my yard. But he will help me when I need it. And the thing that I also learned is that he's not going to come down and have a sit down with me. God's not going to sit across the table from me and negotiate. I don't get to choose who he sends in to be his spokesperson. He sends people, and he sends the right people at the right time with the right word, with the right word to get me straight. Sometimes it's the sponsor, sometimes it's the new guy that has 20 minutes of sobriety. But if I'm listening and I hear the voice and I hear the message, and I understood how important it is never to lose focus on that, because if you stay involved in the center of AA, life gets easy. As soon as you think you've got it in AA, you get it. I want to thank Billy again for having me down. I want to thank you all for being here tonight and listening to me ramble on. There will be no more course correction changes. I will give you back your big book. Thank you very much. Thanks for letting me be here.